Hello, everybody. Dave Hodges here at the Common Sense Show, and we are the show that is freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. Need your help, though. We're in critical times still, even though we got the right guy in office, but we need to stay aware and spread that awareness to other people because Trump needs our popular support. Otherwise, we'll be back where we were in 2020. So please share. We have a really good show for you today, and we're off the beaten path a little bit. Here is we're going to look inside of Iranian politics from a resistance group, and it's going to be fantastic. We have a really knowledgeable guest, Shaheen Gobadi, and we're going to be talking with him in just a moment. Before we do, I need to let you know we're coming to you from the Noble Gold Studios, and despite Trump's best efforts, all the sabotage has put the dollar in question. We got banks in chaos. They can take your money under the Dodd-Frank law of 2010. You're an unsecured creditor in second place. Most people don't know that. You can look that up. I've been a customer of Noble Gold for 7.5 years. I've been an advertiser for almost 9 years, and I recommend you let them come in and help protect you from the bad things that could transpire. I don't want to see people lose everything if things go south, and they're the best at doing it. No call centers, no pressure. They're just helpful answer questions, and you literally have to close your own deal. So here's what you do. Go to davehodgesgold.com. Put in your email. No, we don't sell your data. Put in your email, and I'll send you out an electronic prospectus. It's simple, short, to the point. Answer all your questions. It'll have the number to Noble Gold on it. And I implore you, please do this. Protect yourself. Minimal investment. And also, too, they have investments. They'll talk to you about that when you call. Shaheen, really good to have you on the show. And I was telling you before we went on, I've spoken to a number of people. From Iran. Some have reached out to me, some I've encountered casually. And I'm impressed with how in love they are with the democratic process and how unhappy they are with their current regime under the mullahs. And with that opening statement, I'll just kind of throw it to you and let you explain what you see are problems and what you are doing as part of your group with the NCRI, in terms of trying to rectify the situation and make a regime change.
First of all, Dave, thank you for having me, and
Pleasure.
thank you for having this program. And before I start off, let me wish all of your good viewers a good day and weeks and months to come.
Thank you.
Most welcome. You see, Dave, when it comes to Iran, I think this is a country on the verge of a big change, and I think that's the biggest story. Well, the mullahs have ruled in Iran with iron fist for the last 40 plus years, to be exact, 46 years now. In the course of the past 4 decades, more than 120,000 young and old men and women in Iran have been executed solely for standing up for freedom and democracy. 120,000 people in the course of the past 4 decades. The youngest documented was a 13-year-old teenage girl, was Muslim, but did not want to live under the mullah's imposition. And she was, her only crime was to selling the newspaper of the resistance. It's a 13-year-old girl who sold the newspaper of the resistance, was executed. So we are talking about this kind of a savage regime. So first thing to note is that the main victims of this regime are the Iranian people who really want to get rid of it. But despite all this crackdown, all this cruelty, I can tell you that the regime, the mullahs, are on the last leg. In the last 7.5 years alone, there have been five major nationwide uprisings in Iran,
Well.
each time getting bigger, stronger, more inclusive. The last time that happened was in 2022, that went into 2023, lasted for months and weeks. And it basically covered the whole 31 provinces of Iran, somewhere like 300 cities and towns throughout the country, metropolitan areas, rural areas. And very tellingly, middle-aged people, young people, even Gen Zs, were all in unison. Chanting slogans like "Down with dictator," "Down with oppressor," being the Shah, which was the previous dictatorship, or the supreme leader, which clearly showed Iranian people reject all kinds of dictatorship in any form and shape, and they are ready for a democratic, secular republic. Obviously, that's been costly. The regime in each round has killed, many, many protesters. In one case, 1,500 protesters were killed in a matter of a few days. In another case, the last one, 750 protesters were killed in a matter of, during this process, and 30,000 others were arrested. And obviously, everyone understands what happens to these who are arrested. Yet, The cry for freedom is so deep in Iran that we think another uprising is at works. Now, how does the uprising comes about? There's a vast network of resistance units in Iran, which are affiliated to the main Iranian resistance movement called the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, also known as MEK. And they are active, and a lot of young people, especially young women, are attracted to this. So there's a very, very strong resistance movement and growing inside Iran. And what's also important is that there is a politically viable democratic alternative in the form of National Council of Resistance of Iran. It is like a parliament in exile of the resistance. It includes all the democratic forces which are anti-Shah, which was the previous dictatorship, anti-Mullah, looking for a democratic republic in Iran. And very tellingly, Dave, this is all led by a woman called Madame Maryam Rajavi.
That is so
That's so
unusual
hard
to
to
me,
show.
because the idea of a female politician in largely a Muslim country is certainly different from the norm.
Definitely, this is something very new, and she has been a trailblazer by all accounts, not only politically but also culturally. You have to bear in mind that I said 120,000 good people in Iran have been victimized by the mullahs. Tens of thousands of them have been women, because they have much more to fight for. The regime is very misogynist, treats women as less than second-class citizen, and so these women are fighting for everything. Also, you might find it very telling that more than 50% of the members of the National Council of Resistance of Iran who hold very key positions are women. So not only we have a woman president-elect, but we have women in a very key positions. So that's going to be a very, very different Iran that you will see. And what's also very telling, David, is that the NCRI and actually Madame Rajavi has introduced a 10-point plan for the transitional period. So that when the mullahs are ousted by the Iranian people, there will not be chaos. There will be a smooth transition. There's a clear plan for the transition. And this 10-point plan includes like separation of church and the government, religion and government, total gender equality, total freedom of association, freedom of thought, a non-nuclear Iran, an Iran which is in a friendship with the rest of the world, in a mutual, amiable relationship, and an Iran that recognizes the rights of national minorities. So you can see we are talking about a very, very different Iran. And what's also interesting to note that this 10-point plan of Madame Rajavi is gaining a lot of international recognition. Just 2 weeks ago, 225 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, in a bipartisan way, introduced a resolution in support of Madame Rajavi's 10-point plan. And as you know, bipartisan initiatives are very rare these days in Washington. And the same is happening with a large number of the U.S. senators, again, in a bipartisan way. And just this past Saturday, the majority members of the British House of Commons and House of Lords endorsed Madame Rajavi's 10-point plan. So we are working very hard inside Iran, working very hard internationally to show that the viable democratic alternative is very much out there, and Iran is no longer synonymous with the mullahs.
Let me tell you what I heard, what I read 2 days ago. I read that Iran has mobilized, it looks like it's in preparation for war with its military. Do you have any information on that?
Well, you have to remember this regime has survived on two pillars. One is repression at home and belligerence in the region throughout. Basically, that's why they have created, propped up, financed, trained all these proxies, like Hezbollah in Lebanon, like Houthis in Yemen, and all these Iraqi Shiite militias in Iraq, and so on and so forth. But while the regime situation inside the country has been much, much weaker, as I explained to you, also, regionally speaking, they have been much weaker, especially in 2024. It was devastating for the mullahs. Their main proxy, which was Hezbollah, was decimated very much. Houthis, as you saw, got a lot of beatings.
Yes.
And most importantly, the regime of Bashar Assad in Syria, which was basically like the linchpin of this regime's regional policy for the past 4 decades, was overthrown in 11 days. And with it went the regime's, years and years of investment. So basically, while this regime might be bluffing and making all sorts of blusters, I can tell you it has never been any weaker. And its overthrow has never been more within reach than as we speak today. In another aspect, I would say, so far as the crises are concerned, all the chickens are coming home to roost for the supreme leader Ali Khamenei
But
from all
I do
directions.
have a question about the carrying out of the atrocities against the people by the Iranian government. Was that done by the military or by like a secret police organization?
Actually, there are a series of entities which their own role is to impose the rule of the mullahs on the people. But specifically, there's one entity called the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. This is like the army of the mullahs that they created after the revolution, which is only loyal to the mullahs and supreme leader. And their main task and only task is to suppress Iranian people. Also, they're the main entity for export of terrorism abroad. And their long arm for terror has reached as far away as Latin America, Europe, throughout the whole Middle East. So they're the ones who carry out most of the dirty work and crimes of the mullahs, but not they're not alone. The Minister of Intelligence Security also helps them, and so on and so forth. But if there's one entity that you want to point finger to, that will be the Revolutionary Guards
Okay.
Corps, also IRGC.
Because if there's going to be a toppling of the mullahs, if it's a conventional insurrection, it would have to involve at least some elements of the military. That's why I asked that question.
Well, actually, there's a lot of disenchantment within their ranks and file, but at the end of the day, it's with the Iranian people. And obviously, history has proven, Dave, that when the momentum gets big enough and the avalanche gets big enough, rats are the first who jump the ship. So this is what the history has proven time and again. And you see, a lot of times, these totalitarian regimes on the surface, from the outside, look much stronger than what they actually are. Look what happened in Syria. Who could have thought that the Assad regime will be gone in 11 days? You know, if we had this discussion last year, this looked like, you know, a fanciful. But it happened. But it happened. And I think the mullahs are in a much, much weaker position that it looks like. All this bluster and all this, you know, I would call razzmatazz, or all this smokescreen, is to cover up their big, big, big weakness at home, especially. You see, the mullahs' weakest point, the Ashili Hills, are in the streets of Iranian cities, where the young, restive Iranian people who are looking for another occasion to uprise. And I think that's very important to realize.
Are there elements of the country, like rural or urban, that are ready to rise up? And I'm assuming, like most revolutions, it's being pushed by the young.
Absolutely, and especially the younger generation. And particularly here, I have to underscore the role of young women. You see, they are very well educated. They know what's going on in the world. They're fully aware of this alternative. They're fully aware of Madame Rajavi and her role and her 10-point plan. So they're cognizant. They are fully conscious. And that's why they are willing to put their life on the line for this sort of activities. You know, in the just in last year alone, there were 3,000 activities by resistance units throughout Iran, and 39,000 activities of, you know, publicity, distributing information, leaflets against the regime. And so, if you divide that on almost there, you can see we are talking about a very, very big network. So, yes, the women in Iran and the young men in Iran are ready for change. They know it takes risk, and they have put their lives on the line because they see no future in the regime. On the other hand, they see a viable alternative out there, which gives them hope for the future. And that's why the mullahs are very, very worried about the uptick of the activities of the resistance inside the country. You see, Dave, these days when people talk about Iran and the problem and their drive to acquire nuclear weapons, which is a very, very serious concern, as rightly been addressed by the Trump administration, there's always talk of either you have to bomb the mullahs or you have to accept them with a bomb. We think there's a third option. And this is what Madame Rajavi has been articulating for years and years. We think the best option is a regime change by the Iranians themselves. Now, what does that require? Actually, when Madame Rajavi testified before the US Congress online on February 26, this she was asked, "What do you ask from the United States?" And she said, "We do not want your boots on the ground. We do not advocate getting weapons from the US. We do not seek money from the US. All we want is a good policy. And what's that good policy? To be on the side of the Iranian people and the resistance for regime change." Now, what does that require? First of all, stifle the mullahs' drive for money, prevent them from exporting oil and gas, because every dime, every penny they get is used for repressing Iranian people or to stipend their proxies to support terrorism or to go for nuclear weapons, or is plundered, as simple as this. A huge amount of money in Iran is plundered almost on a daily basis by the mullahs and their IRGC. You might find it striking that as rich of a country as Iran, 80% of the people live below the officially stated poverty line. 80%
80%.
of the country lives below the poverty line. And we are talking about a very rich country, which has the second biggest gas reserves and the fourth biggest oil reserve. Where does all the money go? It's either used, as I said, for repression or helping, Hezbollah and Houthis and that sort of groups, or is plundered or spent on a nuclear program. So first thing is that, that should be cut off. Number two, the UN Security Council resolutions that were suspended because this nuclear deal between Obama and the mullahs back in 2015 have to be reactivated. Number three, the mullahs' leaders should be held accountable for all their crimes against humanity, against Iranian people, and against the world. They are state sponsor number one of terrorism in the world. And number four, the right of the Iranian people to bring about regime change by themselves, for themselves, something that I think every American identify with, should be recognized. Their right to stand up against their oppressors, the IRGC, should be recognized. And these are the only four steps that we think the US should take. And that would be a game changer. And that would send a signal to the mullahs that the, status quo ante, what it was before, is over. And the world is now on the side of the Iranian people and their desire for regime change.
No, it makes a lot of sense. You know, what I'm hearing from you is what I'm seeing in China, where a good number of the young adults, say ages 21 to 35, they have a saying called Ben Loi, which means let it rot. And they're choosing not to participate in mainstream communist China activities because they see it as a rigged game, depriving them of liberty. So a lot of them are becoming domestic engineers in their parents' homes, and the apathy is destroying the economy of China. And is there such a parallel in Iran where the young people are just apathetic to the government and they just ignore them?
Totally. You see, but a big difference here, Dave, if I may say. In Iran, the situation is so explosive that people come to streets, as I said, despite the crackdown. I told you, five major nationwide uprisings. People know they realize there will be retribution. There will be not only retribution against them, but their families, their siblings. But they are willing to take the risk. One thing is because, you see, we are talking about Iran, a country which has been striving for democracy in the past 120 years. The people's cry for freedom is nothing new in Iran. They fought against the Shah because he was also a despot, and they overthrew him. But unfortunately, when came the time for change, an imposter like Khomeini, pulled wool on the people's eyes, and he beguiled them. So this time, the people of Iran have learned. They have an organized resistance. They have a clear platform. They have an identifiable leader. They're getting international recognition. So this would be a very different situation. Yes, nobody in Iran these days wants to be identified in this regime. According to the regime's own figures, Dave, only 4% of the people support this regime. And this is according to official figures, only 4%. Obviously, the mullahs have kept the people under their yoke by sheer repression and, as I said, augmented with the belligerence in the region. But everyone knows that this is untenable and they are on a slippery slope and the clock is ticking very fast. And that's why they are very, very fearful of another uprising because they know if another big one happens, this could be the very last one.
Well, Trump has done a pretty good job of isolating the Iranian government with his deals with Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And Russia's backed off their support in a large measure for Iran, because I think one day Putin would like to ally with the United States. And so Iran's pretty much standing alone. But here's my caveat on this. I keep hearing and reading, and I want you to confirm or disconfirm this, that the mullahs are hopelessly fatalistic. And they want to force the end days, the end of times, to fulfill a prophecy of negativity. Is there any truth in that?
Well, I would say this. The mullahs will stop at not committing any crime that one can imagine to forestall their overthrow. The things they have done to Iranian people and to the world is unimaginable, is unfathomable. What they have done, the crimes they have committed, the type of crimes they have committed, Look what they did to Syria. Look what they, you know, they have known they have no principle whatsoever. They want to start over, but they're very weak. I think that's the point to be made here, and they get much weaker. But as I said, they should not be given no leeway. You see, Dave, in the last 3 decades, unfortunately, the policy that was pursued by, you know, people like Obama or Biden or Clinton to that effect, and the Europeans, was what I call appeasement. They were always living in their mirages that somehow they can sweeten deal with the mullahs, and somehow the mullahs will come to their senses. And throughout this whole time, we said this is fanciful. The mullahs would never come to terms with the world. They are killers, and they should not be given any concessions. And do you know who lost because of those concessions? The world community, and first and foremost, the Iranian people that organized resistance. So lessons to be drawn here. Lessons to be learned here. There should be no appeasement and no concessions made. And today, as we speak, as I said, the mullahs are very weak. Their backs are against the wall. And as I said, they should not be given any chance. I think they are on the last leg, and they should be seen as it is. During the nuclear talks, they should not be given any concessions. They have no leverage. You see, 10 years ago, they could always play the Trump card of, you know, their proxies in the region. But that's now out of the game. You know, that's removed. 10 years ago, when they did this deal with Obama, and Obama gave him all sorts of unwarranted concessions, the situation inside Iran was not as tumultuous as it is today. So you see every element now in the side of a very decisive approach. And do you know what has been missing, Dave, in all these years? The role of the Iranian people and the organized resistance. That's a game changer. That's the mullahs, you know, Achilles heels. And I think that's the one that should be brought in. And that will send a message immediately to the Iranian people and also to the regime at the same time, that a new dawn is coming.
But I want to go back to the question I had. I'd like to kind of complete this thought to confirm or disconfirm. Specifically, I've read and been told that the mullahs want to bring back the Mahdi and end times, and so they don't care how bad things get. Is that a true statement?
To some extent, yes. But at the same time, as John Adams famously said, facts are stubborn things. So the realities impose themselves on the mullahs, no matter what they want in their, you know, distorted minds and mindset. You know, the tide is turning against them. Obviously, they don't want this to be the case, but the reality is something else. Yes, some of them think, you know, this might be the, you know, this could come to apocalypse and things like this.
Yes.
They talk about this, but I can tell you, the Iranian people will not allow this to happen. The clock is ticking much faster than one can perceive. We are at the end of a process. We are in the beginning of a process. That's the whole point.
No, I agree. There's three elements I see that could bring about regime change. One is apathy, and the country just destroys itself, and the government falls apart through indifference. I don't know that that's going to happen in that strong of a totalitarian regime. But number two, the military rises up, at least portions of the military, and they do away with the bodyguards of the mullah and their enforcement troops, and then they take the mullahs out of power. Or the protection organism for the mullahs get compromised, like how many assassinations happen in other countries. You compromise the protection, you take out the leaders, and then regime change happens. If you were to look along that spectrum, is there anything you see that's most likely, or do you have another one of your own?
I think what we saw in 1979 in Iran was that despite the fact that they faced a dictator, obviously it's a different kind of dictatorship under the Shah. It was a modern dictator, but people came to streets in such a big numbers that they overwhelmed the regime.
Yes.
And the momentum became so big that they could not contain it. And this time, obviously, I'm not saying the situations are carbon copy. History never repeats itself in a carbon copy way. But at the same time, this time there's an organized resistance. That's a big difference. It leads the people's way. This resistance unit, as I said, is their role to lead, to direct the protests. And you see, that's what makes the mullahs very worried, that this people's apathy, disenchantment, rage has a sense of direction. It's all pointed towards the regime and its leadership. And that's what makes it very scary for the mullahs. And as I said, especially the fact that the resistance has a face, a woman, with a program, with international recognition. And these are very, very important aspects at this time of age.
Yeah, I need to get you on some of my colleagues' shows because they need to be hearing this. But boy, the context of this is so confusing because let me give you my perception of the American perspective. Uranium can't get to 90. These mullahs can never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. And I agree with that philosophy. And here I think Trump is caught between two goals here. One is let naturally occurring consequences happen in Iran and he have a regime change, problem solved, but he may not feel he has the time to do it before the mullahs could develop nuclear weapons. Can you address that?
I totally agree. The mullahs should not have the weapons. You see, this nuclear program from the day one was for nuclear weapons. There was nothing civilian about it. There was nothing patriotic about it. And Dave, I'm talking from National Council of Resistance of Iran. We are the movement that has made 110 revelations about the Iranian regime's secret nuclear sites, projects, key researchers. If it were not for our revelations, which are only done through vast network of the resistance units throughout the country, which are like eyes and ears of the world in Iran, in some of the most secret aspects of the mullahs' nuclear weapons program, the mullahs would have had the bomb by now. It was actually us who told on them, and the world woke up.
That is fantastic. I mean, I want to praise your efforts in this because you're working towards world peace, not just national freedom, but you're working towards world peace when you do that. And giving up that
Exactly, David.
information to the American government works wonders. And this is why, I've told you, I respect the Iranian people. I don't want a war with Iran, but I know if we don't, if we allow the mullahs to get nuclear weapons, it's going to be a lot worse than if we attacked Iran because it'll involve the world.
No, actually, you're absolutely correct. I'll always remind you of the famous sentence by Churchill, who said after the infamous Chamberlain agreement with Hitler back in 1938, he said you could have chosen between war and dishonor, and you chose dishonor, and dishonor will get you to war. So, absolutely correct. The mullahs should not get the bomb. But as I said, the narrative that either you bomb them or you have to make a big concession is a wrong narrative. That's a narrative that mullahs propagated over the years by their think tanks, by their useful idiots and this kind of a quote unquote experts who are actually directed from Tehran. I think the game changer here is that there is a third option. Let's bet on the Iranian people and their resistance to bring about a change. And that's what the mullahs did not want the world to know of, to hear of, and to be aware of. And you're absolutely correct. If there's enough pressure on the mullahs, they have no choice but to give up their nuclear program.
Well, let's go back to the
We
Shah of Iran for a second as a
sure.
parallel. What drove him out was America could no longer support him because of what was being exposed, but it was the people that took to the streets that forced him out. Do you see
Exactly.
something like that happening with the mullahs?
It's happening. I told you there has been five uprisings in Iran in the last 7 years alone. And you have to remember, the 7 years included 1.5 years with COVID. So it's basically like one uprising every year. So in that sense, and each time it's getting bigger, more inclusive, more pervasive, and not only one part of the country, in all 31 provinces, in 300 cities and towns, despite all the crackdown, all the ruthlessness of the IRGC, all of this, but people come out and battle them. Gen Zs, women.
It's amazing. And it looks like we may have lost our guest here temporarily. So hopefully he'll come back in with a request to rejoin. But I want to just add on to what he's saying. I think he's thinking a popular uprising will take care of this. And I tend to agree with that. Okay, we got Shaheen back. And of course, no one would ever take us down. No one would ever have a problem, right? But anyway, he's back. And what we were discussing, as I had just mentioned after we lost Shaheen, we have a situation where I think we're both in agreement. The people are going to take to the streets in such volume, it very well could force the mullahs to abdicate and to leave the country. Is that your feeling on that?
That's going to be definitely the case. As I said, there has been five uprisings in Iran in the last 7 years alone, and each time it's getting bigger, stronger, more inclusive, young and old, middle-aged people. even Gen Zs, all in unison. And you have to remember the main factor here is, as I said, the organized resistance, because they direct the people's uprisings, they lead them. And that's what makes the mullahs very, very worried and edgy, because they see that this dissent is being directed. And you see, a day almost doesn't go by where the regime and in the state media and its officials and its experts do not warn about the role of the resistance. They talk about it now, despite the fact that they don't want to mention it. This is now talk about this in Iranian and the state press, because for years they tried to create this image that the resistance doesn't exist, but that doesn't work anymore,
Sure.
because they realize that it's getting too big and people are too informed. So in that sense, things have changed dramatically, and as I said, that's the factor that has been ignored for too long. If you tell me what's been the biggest missing element, the Western approach towards Iran, including U.S. approach in the last 4 decades and last 3 decades, I said they basically did not factor in the role that the people and the resistance play, and that's what the mullahs did not want the world to know, and that's what they actually went out of their way to even demonize the resistance.
Sure.
Because if the world knows that there's a viable alternative out there, there's a democratic alternative out there, which has a lot of support inside Iran, then they say, why are we making concessions to the mullahs? It doesn't make any sense.
Are they
That's
making any concessions to your group?
who?
The mullahs, are they making any
No,
concessions?
I'm saying that they would know the world people or public opinion would say why the Western governments are making concessions to the mullahs,
I
like the way.
understand what you're saying, but usually when you're trying to stay in power and public opinion is against you, you at least try to make some token concessions to slow down that rebellion. Are you seeing that?
Absolutely not, because then I come back to your correct observation. You see, the mullahs are fully aware if that the moment there's a crackdown, there's a crack in the rule, it will immediately, like it's like a crack in the dam. If you have a crack in the dam, what happens? It opens and very quickly becomes a big wedge, and then there will be a sluge, and then it would overwhelm you. So what I'm saying is that especially the supreme leader knows that if he backs down one step, that one step would not be too far away from the last step.
Yeah.
So that's why we think it's fanciful, and we have maintained this for years and years, Dave. That's fanciful to think that these mullahs will make a significant concession. It's fanciful to think that they will moderate themselves. It's fanciful to think about a pragmatist,
I
mullah
agree.
among them. So that's what we believed, and I think now, on May 2025, a lot of things have become clear that, what we said bear itself out, and people see that what we said were facts and reality based on a resistance which is basically on the country and with a big presence and knows things because we are there. As simple as this.
Do you know, let me tell you how I knew that Trump was going to win and the MAGA movement was going to really enhance. It's when the media ratings of the mainstream media plummeted. People just stopped listening. They tuned out. Are you seeing something similar in Iran right now?
Oh, people have no trust in the official media, none whatsoever.
Okay. But is that
I
a
mean,
general feeling among the people?
oh yes, they totally realize this is all lies, lies, lies. A lot of people in Iran say, look, if the mullahs now tell you it's day, you have to know it's night. And if he doesn't tell you night, you have to know it's white, it's day. They realize anything that the regime says, you have to flip-flop it to get the reality.
Okay.
But also, what's important here is that the resistance, despite all the internet filtering, despite all the regime censorship, the people of Iran get the news. They are aware of what's happening through the resistance activities. They get access to the
What kind of activities
official.
spread that information?
I mean, we obviously there are satellite televisions that are somewhat supportive to the resistance, and they're broadcasting to Iran 24/7, despite risks. But millions and millions of people watch it. And you have to remember it's 24/7. So that's very helpful. And that's a huge undertaking by resistance, which, by the way, I think you will find it interesting that this resistance only financially supported by the Iranian people. It has never got any money from any foreign government and never sought it, only by the support of the Iranians inside Iran, many of whom were executed solely for providing financial support, and also by the diaspora. So one way of getting information is through this satellite TVs, which are, as I said, supportive of the resistance and sympathetic, and they broadcast into Iran. Also through a lot of websites, and a lot of young people break the censorship through VPNs and all sorts of other methods and get access to the. And also, another aspect is that the resistance units write a big graffiti on the walls, huge graffiti, or they distribute leaflets at night, or when a lot of on the pedestrian bridges, they put the big banners of Madame Rajavi, even sometimes daytime with huge risks, with her message and her 10-point plan. And this is almost a daily event these days in Iran. So, yes, people are aware of what's happening, and that's why they're joining.
Sounds like the movie V for Vendetta with the graffiti. That's what it put me in the mind of. And it's very, very effective because now you're getting word of mouth spreading.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
Actually,
that's fantastic.
some of these young women have spoken to Western media in the past and have explained the dangers they face, but they do it. They do it. You see, these resistance units are normal people. In the daytime, they're a school teacher, a nurse, an engineer, an office worker. And at night, they get together and start working.
That's
They spread the
very
word.
that's very Viet Cong. I mean, that's why the Viet Cong were so successful against both the French and the Americans in that war. It's a very similar concept. You know, farmer by day and activist soldier by night.
Well,
Is there sabotage going on inside the country?
no, they don't do sabotage, but they do, as I said, for instance, burn the big pictures of Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, or the statue of Khamenei, the symbols of the regime. So, and this happens neighborhood by neighborhood. So when you go in the morning and see a big picture of Khamenei burned, you know it's a work of the resistance units. So these are, and as I said, they're everywhere in all 31 provinces. And as I said, they're in the society. They are like a fish, moving around in their own pond or in their own lake. So,
Let
and
me
I
say the most negative thing that I'm going to say. When you back dictators up into a corner, and that sounds like it's happening there, they usually go in two directions. One, they'll go to war to mobilize the country, or and we certainly have that possibility here, or two, they starve the people into submission. I don't know that time is on your side because Trump is not going to allow the mullahs to have a nuclear weapon.
I think time is on the side of the people of the resistance, in that sense that I think the clock is ticking very fast against the mullahs. So far as
I hope
starving is
so.
concerned, they have already starved Iranian people. I told you, with such a rich nation, 80% of the people living below the poverty line, having difficulty to make the ends meet, to feed their family, that's some kind of a starvation on its own
Sure,
capacity.
sure.
But the mullahs going to war, they know they cannot because the people are not going to go fight for them. They know that full well. They know, look, they have gone through all of this over the years. They justified, for instance, supporting Bashar Assad as saying that, oh, this is a holy duty. Okay, thousands of the Revolution Guards were killed. They mobilized up to 100,000 proxies. You know how expensive that is? For years to prop up Bashar Assad. But this whole thing went up in 11 days. And now that was very much, difficult for the regime and the leader to explain to his own retinue. But what happened? What happened? The regime invested $50 billion on Assad regime in the last 10 years alone. $50 billion. And it all went up in the smoke in 11 days. So when I said we are at the end of a process, I meant these steps were taken. The regime's, charades, the regime's, religious posturing, the regime's, demagogy, they have all run its course. People are aware, they're educated. Iranian people are probably the most educated people in the whole Middle East, and they know what's going on. So, and they want to wrest their country from the hands of these people. Actually, that's why the resistance is growing, because the situation is ripe. People know that this is the only way for their future. The young people, as educated as they are, have no future, and as you said, the mullahs are very dangerous because they're pushed to the corner. But we think, in order to prevent them to go something, hyperbolic, is to support the resistance. But as I said, you're absolutely correct. They have starved the people to contain them, to make them apolitical, to not them think about issues, just to think about how to feed their family. They have done that. They have imposed very harsh censorship. They have twisted facts and history about the resistance. They don't want, they, for years, they ignored and said this resistance doesn't exist. But 45 years is a long time. And we endured and we endured and we endured and we removed obstacles one after the other. Obstacles that at times they sounded and looked insurmountable. But since there was a deep desire for freedom in Iran, we overcame all of that. And that's where we are today.
It's I just hope there's not the Tiananmen Square, but the mullahs are they're as crazy as the CCP in China. I think they'll go down fighting to the last dog.
But they will fight. They will fight. They're not going to be talked out of the office. No, that's for sure. But
That's right.
again, their base of support is narrowing and narrowing. And it, actually, you know, one of the issues that worries them, they said in their own state press that the message of the resistance is coming to our homes, to our grandchildren, to our own children. Their mullah's grandchildren are asking them, why did you kill these people? Let me make you one example. In 1988, in summer of 1988, upon a order of Khomeini, the founder of this regime, 30,000 prisoners, political prisoners, who were already serving their terms, they were already in jail serving their terms, were executed in a matter of 3 months. Think of it, 30,000 people who are already in jail in this regime were massacred upon Khomeini's order because he said any prisoner who is firm and steadfast in his or her belief and is not willing to give up and is not willing to repent has to be executed. And the target were mostly the activists of the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, MEK, which is like an antidote of this regime. And can you imagine 30,000 executions in 3 months? You know, some days there were 400, 500, 600 executions a day. So, but now a lot of the grandchildren of those mullahs who killed these prisoners and massacred them. According to UN, this is a UN experts and a special rapporteur in Iran, this is very much like a genocide.
Yes, well, it is a genocide, yeah.
They said, now a lot of their grandchildren are asking, why did we do this? What justified our execution like this? Who authorized this? So what I'm saying is, now the tide has turned. Now we are talking a very different situation. The mullahs are running out of recourse, as you said. Does it mean that they're going to give up easily? Absolutely not. It's going to be tumultuous. It's going to be challenging, but the momentum is on our side. All we're asking is a good policy, as you said. No more appeasement, no more concessions. Hear the voice of the resistance, factor it in, and let the rest upon the Iranian people and their organized resistance. We are up to the challenge. We always say the Iranian problem has a solution.
I see that. Well, I gotta wonder what Trump is doing on the ground behind the scenes, because this is a whole lot better solution than going to war. And this is why I pray that you have enough time to pull this off. But there is a downside for the mullahs and what they've done. So let me ask you this question preliminarily to my main question. Do you have any estimate as to how many people in the Iranian army are conscripts and drafted as opposed to career military?
Yes, about up more than 80, 90% of them are conscripts.
Yeah,
Again,
see, the mullahs are playing with fire, because when you
exactly.
mobilize your military and you got 80, 90% conscripts and the people are unhappy, that could be turned on the mullahs.
Exactly. That's why they don't trust nobody anymore. That's the whole point. Because look, obviously cadres are cadres, but you know, but when the tide becomes too big, they have no chance. They will be melted like a snow in a summer day in Arizona. Let's put it like this.
Well, you know our weather. I think this is a fantastic movement here, but it's not getting enough play. And here's what concerns me. The former mainstream media, and I'm going to say it this way, Shaheen, I've got several media outlets, and I outdraw Fox and I outdraw MSNBC and CNN, and so do all my colleagues that I work with. They all do. I mean, no one's watching these people. And so what I'm saying though is, why do you think the American former mainstream media is not covering what you're talking about?
Well, I think that's been part and parcel of what I call the appeasement policy. You know, when Ben Rhodes and Obama people, I'm sure you know Ben Rhodes, who was in the Obama White
Yeah.
House, had his echo chamber always echoing what the official line from White House was. There was no room for the resistance to be heard. And this is exactly what the mullahs always demand, Dave. They say, oh, do not give voice to the people. Only make Iran univoice, if I may say so. It's either the Iranian regime or nobody. And I think you are absolutely correct, Dave. Our voice has to be heard. And I think, honestly speaking, it will be very appealing to a lot of good Americans. Because this is a story of an underdog, which is fighting for a good cause.
Yeah, I've got a friend named Sarah Westall. She's number one international business, and she does cover stuff like this. And I got another friend, Paul Preston, out in California. He's the head of the New California Movement, but his show is the top-rated digital show in America. I mean, those are who some of my colleagues are. And this is the kind of thing they cover. This is why I'm going to give your name and contact information to these people, because this story, I got to believe this. Biden's administration, he didn't believe anything because he was out of it. But Biden's administration, the Obama administration, want Iran to have a nuclear weapon because they're serving a group that wants a third world war. That's my personal feeling. And I think that's what you've been up against.
And
And this
also
is why,
Clinton people, and
well,
also
this is why the
Clinton people.
mainstream media is not covering what you guys are doing because the mainstream media is in lockstep with the Democratic Party.
I couldn't agree with you more, and also with the Clinton people. So I totally agree. I think the word has to get out. I think here the public opinion can play a big role. And I think it's what time to be hear much more about this movement. It's Madam President Maryam Rajavi, her 10-point plan. And the good thing, Dave, is here that the U.S. Congress is now siding with the resistance and a lot of good senators. We think a
I can
lot
tell you why. It's because of Israel and not
of.
Netanyahu's gone off the rails right now. I mean, the man's gone nuts. I mean, he's won the Gaza war, he's won Hamas not being an immediate threat, but he's going way beyond what many Americans feel is appropriate. And I don't think he's your friend.
I think, you know, to be honest with you, it's also people realize that the mullahs are a big danger, as you said, because of nuclear
Yeah.
weapons program. And I think now they realize that the previous policies failed, as simple as this. All the things that were told American people about, you know, the mullahs would go moderate, mullahs would do this, mullahs would do this, or the nuclear deal is a good one. They were all proven to be just wishful thinking, fanciful, to put it mildly. To put it mildly.
Now, earlier in this interview, you mentioned Neville Chamberlain, and that's one of the main lessons of history. Is you can't appease tyrants, you have to oppose them.
Churchill said famously that an appeaser is the last one who hopes to be eaten by the crocodile.
Yeah, exactly. And I just look at other countries when they had this chance to stop their dictators and they didn't. I mean, look at Mao, killed estimated 60 to 80 million of his own people, and yet he could have been stopped at one time.
I think this time Iranians are determined, Dave, and I think after all these years, what they have gone through, they rejected one dictatorship in the Shah, they're rejecting this one. Iran can be once again a big, big contributor to the international community. It's one of the cradles of civilization, Iran. So I think with this plan,
It
with this
is.
president-elect, with this resistance, the future can be very bright. And I think the more people hear about us, the better the possibilities for a better policy.
I have two questions before we close. First is about the United Nations. With 120,000 people executed for political beliefs, sometimes religious beliefs, 120,000 people killed like this, that's a crime against humanity. Has the UN offered any support at all to get this stopped?
Well, there's every year this UN resolution at the General Assembly for the last almost 40 years that we have been instrumental to bring it there. But when it came to big issues like the 1988 massacre, for 30 years, 30 some years, we had to fight with tooth and nail to get the UN recognize this as a crime against humanity. And it was at the last year in 2024, upon the courageous act of this UN a special rapporteur on Iran that was eventually done. So no, actually,
Okay.
unfortunately, UN was very, very reluctant. They did not want to rock the boat with the mullahs, and all this inertia. So and if it were not for our endeavors, they would have never done it.
I agree. So, okay, people listening to this broadcast and other broadcasts you're going to do in America, what can the American people do, if anything, to help?
They can go to their congressmen and senators and say, "Be on the side of these people." They can say, "We support this cause. We support these people because they're not asking any money from us. They're not asking for any weapons. They are not for a war. They are not for boots on the ground. So we should give them political support and recognition, and go for the recognizing their right to stand up against the mullahs and to bring about a regime change. They can go
When
to our website and they can go to
Israel
our."
fought their original war of independence, that's basically the support. When Israel fought their original war of independence, that was originally what the president and our Congress did with Israel. Hey, we support you, but you're on your own.
Well, I think it's important to say to the Iranian people that and to the regime that we recognize the right of the Iranian people and their organized resistance to bring about a regime change and to stand up against IRGC.
Yeah, I hear you. Look, I want to compliment you for your courage and your steadfastness to principles. And just out of curiosity, I know that your people are in exile. Are you able to tell us what kind of places you're going to for exile? Who's supporting you?
Well, I'm reaching you today from Paris. That's where our main headquarters are, political headquarters. But we have offices in Washington, London, Brussels, Rome. And our support organizations are all over the world. There are more than 550 cities and towns throughout the world. Actually, in the United States, in more than 40 states, good Iranian Americans support us. And they are very well successful Iranians. Businessmen, technocrats, academicians who support our cause. Actually, the support among diaspora is very strong. To give you an idea, every year there's a big annual event of the resistance, and upward to 100,000 expatriates from all over the world, including all over the United States, Canada, come and take part. So yes, this
Exactly.
movement is really, really grassroots and has support in the United States, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, throughout the Europe, Middle East, and most importantly, inside Iran. And I think that's the key, the support of the people.
Shaheen, I want to point out what's on the screen, because when we strip the audio here and it goes out to podcast and radio networks that we're on, they won't be able to see this. So I want to give this out over the air. It's NCR-Iran. So it's N as in Nancy, C as in Charlie, R as in Robert, NCR-Iran.org. And that's where you can go to follow this movement and find out more about it than we had the time to cover in less than an hour. Shaheen, you've been a wonderful interview. And I will see what I can do to generate some interest on my side of the media. Because what you're doing is, like I said, you're not just helping people in Iran, you are actually helping to preserve world peace. There's no
Dave,
question about it.
thank you for having me in the show. Once again, thanks for all the good intentions, for
Yeah.
all of your good viewers, all of your good listeners, and may God bless you and all of your viewers and listeners. But I think you have got your finger on the pulse. What we are doing, obviously, first and foremost, is for Iran, but that's also for the Middle East and also for the whole world.
No, yeah,
And I
absolutely.
think you got that very correct, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank
Thanks
you very
again.
much for coming on. We've been speaking with Shaheen Gobadi, and you've gave the website out. We'll also publish it in our description. And we want to thank everyone for being with us, and we'll see you back here next time. God bless you.
Thank you. God bless you too.